Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we are really rolling up our sleeves. I feel like we're leaving the kiddie pool. We are moving beyond the simple, clean lines of introductory statistics and stepping in to the messy, multidimensional, and frankly, much more interesting real world.
It is a necessary transition, a rite of passage, really. Up until now, if you've been following the standard economics curriculum, we've mostly looked at the relationship between two things. You know, bivariate analysis.
Right, just one X and one Y.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Does education raise wages? Does height predict basketball ability? Nice, simple, two-variable questions, one X, one Y. And you can imagine a straight line in between them.
Right, the classic X and Y graph, the kind of thing you can draw on a napkin. But today, we are tackling data summary with multiple regression. And based on the stack of notes you've brought and the fact that we're diving into Chapter 10 of the analysis of economics data, this feels like we're leveling up. This isn't just intro to stats anymore.
We are absolutely leveling up. And this deep dive, we've designed it specifically to be a study companion. So if you are a first-year economics student, or maybe a professional trying to remember how economists actually model the world, this is really the foundational methodology.
Okay.
We aren't just going to chat our concepts. We're going to try to master the definitions, the specific interpretation of the results, and the actual procedural steps you need to take to run these models without embarrassing yourself.
So consider this your audio study guide. Maybe you're on the bus to an exam right now. We've got you covered. The mission today is specific.
Yeah.
How do we analyze economic data when a dependent variable, the thing we're trying to explain, is determined by multiple factors simultaneously, not just one?
Because that is the reality of the world. In the real world, I mean, nothing is caused by just one thing.
Yeah.
We're going to use house prices as our anchor example today. And just think about it. A house price isn't just determined by its size.
No, of course not.
It's about location, the number of bedrooms, the bathrooms, the age of the house, maybe even the time of year it's sold. If you try to explain price with just size, you're missing huge chunks of the picture. You're oversimplifying to the point of being wrong.
Okay, let's unpack this. The source material highlights a major shift right off the bat, and it's something that might make visual learners a little nervous. It says that once we move to multiple regression, we can't rely as much on visual methods, so no more simple scatter plots telling the whole story.
That is the biggest initial hurdle. It's the challenge of multiple dimensions. When you have one Y, say, price, and one X, size, you can draw a nice 2D scatter plot. You can literally see the data points, and you can take a ruler and kind of draw the line of best fit through them. It's intuitive.
Yeah, you can eyeball it.
You can eyeball it. But what happens when you have one Y and, say, five different X variables?
I guess you'd need a six-dimensional piece of paper to draw that.
Which is notoriously hard to buy at the campus bookstore. Theoretically, we're moving from fitting a line on a flat plane to fitting a plane, or what we call a hyperplane, in a multidimensional space. And since our brains aren't wired to visualize six dimensions, we can't just eyeball it anymore.
So we have to trust the math.
We have to rely much more heavily on the statistics, the coefficients, and the diagnostics to tell us if the model is good. The math becomes our eyes.
The source also drops a phrase here that usually makes liberal arts majors break out in a cold sweat. Matrix algebra.
Yes. Look, don't panic. We are going to focus on the concepts today.
Yeah.
But strictly speaking, to calculate the best estimates for these complicated models involving 5 or 10 variables, you can't just use simple high school algebra anymore. You need matrix algebra.
We aren't going to do matrix multiplication on the podcast, right? Please tell me we're not.
We will spare you that.
Yeah.
But you should know that underneath the hood of your software, whether it's data, R, or even Excel matrix algebra, is the engine running the show. It's solving systems of equations simultaneously to find the optimal answers.
Good to know.
Yes.
And we're also going to introduce some new tools to help us navigate this invisible multidimensional space, something called adjusted R squared, which it sounds like a correction for overconfidence.
That is a very, very accurate way to describe it, actually. It's the metric that keeps us honest.
Okay, let's ground this in reality. We need a data set to make sense of all this math. We are going back in time. We're going to 1999. To Davis, California.
A very specific place and time. We have a data set of just 29 houses sold in central Davis in 1999. Now, it's a small sample. Normally, you'd want a lot more than 29 observations. But for a textbook example, it's perfect. It illustrates the mechanics of the math without getting bogged down in big data.
So our dependent variable, our target, is price. That's right. Our Y. And then we have a list of regressors, the variables we think explain the price. We've got size in square feet, bedrooms, bathrooms, lot size, age, and the month sold.
And we need to be really precise about definitions here. This is step one of any analysis, know your data. In this data set, for instance, lot size isn't square footage. It's a category. One for small, two for medium, three for large.
Okay, that's important.
It's very important. If you treat that as a continuous number without realizing it's a category, you might really misinterpret things.
Mm.
And there's a quirky little note in the source about bathrooms.
Yes, the specific definition of a half bathroom. The text specifies that a half bath is a lavatory without bath or shower. Just so we're all visualizing the same real estate listings here.
It sounds trivial, but it's so important for the data entry. If you code a half bath as a full bath, or you ignore it, the math receives the wrong inputs. Garbage in, garbage out. It all starts there.
So step one in our study guide process, exploratory analysis. Before we run the big complex model, we just look at the data. What are we seeing in the Davis housing market back in 1999?
Well, the summary statistics, they paint a picture. The mean sales price is $253,910.
Which I have to say is painful to hear. Depending on where you live today, $250,000 for a house in California sounds like fiction.
Inflation is a real thing, and the California housing market has certainly evolved since then.
Yeah.
But for 1999, that was the market. The mean size is 1,883 square feet. The average house has about 3.8 bedrooms and 2.2 bathrooms. And the average age is 36 years.
So these are established family homes, not brand new builds.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned we can't visualize the whole model at once because of all the dimensions, but the source suggests we shouldn't just fly blind. We should still look at two-way scatter plots.
Yes. Just because we can't see the six-dimensional hyperplane doesn't mean we shouldn't look at the parts. So we start with pairwise correlations. We basically line up every variable against every other variable just to see who's holding hands, who's related to who.
Okay, so I'm looking at the correlation matrix in the notes. Price is the big one we care about.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like price is most highly correlated with size. The correlation is 0.79.
That's a strong correlation. It makes intuitive sense. Bigger house, higher price. A correlation of 0.79 is quite strong. If you saw that, you think, okay, size is probably the main driver here.
But here is where it gets tricky. And I think this is where students get tripped up all the time. There's also a correlation between price and bedrooms. It's 0.43. So 0.43 is a decent positive correlation. If I'm just looking at that, I'm thinking, great, if I add more bedrooms, the price goes up.
And that is the trap. The source puts a big warning label on this. This is the proxy warning. And it is the fundamental reason we need multiple regression. Yes, bedrooms correlate with price, but now look at the correlation between bedrooms and size.
I'm looking at bedrooms and size. Okay, that's 0.52.
Exactly. They're correlated with each other. Big houses tend to have more bedrooms. You rarely see a 5,000 square foot house with one bedroom, and you rarely see a 5,000 square foot house with five bedrooms.
So they move together.
They move together. So when we see that high price for a five bedroom house, is it high because people really truly value the fifth bedroom itself? Or is it just because a five bedroom house tends to be 3,000 square feet, and what people are really paying for is the massive amount of floor space?
It's the classic correlation is not causation trap, but it's a specific flavor of it where variables are piggybacking on each other.
We call it a confounding variable. In this case, size is confounding the relationship between bedrooms and price. If we just ran a simple regression of price on bedrooms, the bedroom variable would get credit for the size effect. It would look like bedrooms are incredibly valuable, but really they're just acting as a proxy for the real value, which is space.
So we need a referee. We need something to step in and say, okay, size, you go to this corner, bedrooms, you go to that corner. I want to see what you are each worth separately.
That is exactly what multiple regression does. It acts as the referee. It separates the players. It asks the critical question. Okay, holding the size constant. So imagine two houses that are the exact same square footage. Do people still pay more for an extra bedroom?
That is the aha moment. We're trying to isolate the specific contribution of each factor. So let's build the machine that does that. Let's move to the second part of our study guide, the model.
This is the formal setup. We are defining an equation, and it looks like this. He hat equals B1 plus B2X2 plus B3X3 and so on up to BKXK.
Let's translate that from math to English because that can look a little intimidating on a whiteboard. So hey hat, that's our predicted price.
Correct. The little hat on the Y, it's literally circumflex, means it's an estimate, a prediction. It's not the actual price the house sold for. It's what our math thinks it should sell for.
And the X's are our data.
The X's are our data size, bedrooms, age, and the B's. Those are the gold. Those are the coefficients we are trying to find.
So B1 is the intercept, the starting point, and B2, B3, and so on are the weights we assign to each variable.
Exactly. Think of them as price tags. B2 is the price tag for 1 square foot of space. B3 is the price tag for 1 bedroom. Our job is to find the correct price tags that make our prediction match reality as closely as possible.
So how do we find the best numbers for B? How do we know that B2 should be 10 or 100 or something else?
We use a method called ordinary least squares, or OLS. And the logic is actually surprisingly intuitive. We want to make our mistakes as small as possible.
And by mistakes, you mean the difference between what our model predicts the house costs and what it actually sold for.
Yes. That difference is called the residual, which we denote as EI. Mm-hmm. For every single house in the data set, there is a residual. Actual price minus predicted price. Some of our guesses will be too high, some will be too low.
And we want to minimize those residuals. But wait, if some are positive and some are negative, won't they just cancel each other out if we add them all up?
That's a very sharp observation. Yes, you just added the errors. A plus $10,000 error and a minus $10,000 error would look like zero error. And that's bad. We want to count all the errors, regardless of their direction. So we square them.
Ah, because squaring a negative number makes it positive.
Exactly. Negative 10,000 squared is a massive positive number. This does two really important things. It solves the sign problem, and it heavily penalizes big mistakes. The model tries incredibly hard to avoid being way off on any single house. Our goal is to find the B's that make the sum of these squared residuals as tiny as mathematically possible.
And doing that requires calculus, or as you said before, that matrix algebra.
It leads us to a set of equations we call the normal equations. Now, we don't need to solve them by hand here, but there is a property of the solution that is fascinating, and it's crucial for understanding what the model is actually doing.
Okay.
When you solve for the best B's, the math guarantees that every regressor, every X, is orthogonal to the residual.
Orthogonal. That's a heavy word. In geometry, that means perpendicular, right? Like at a 90-degree angle.
Right. But in statistics, you can think of it as unconnected or uncorrelated. Effectively, it means we have squeezed every single drop of information out of that variable. There is no pattern left in the errors that correlates with size or with bedrooms. We've extracted all the juice.
So if there was still a pattern, it would mean our model was wrong.
It would mean we picked the wrong coefficient. OLS ensures we pick the one that drains the pattern completely dry.
Now, there is a concept here in the notes that I think is probably the most important part of this entire chapter. It's a way of visualizing what a multiple regression coefficient actually is, the partialing out concept. It uses an analogy of running a regression on residuals. This is a bit complex, so can we walk through this slowly?
This is the deepest insight in the chapter, I think. And if you get this, you get multiple regression. So let's say we want to find B2, the coefficient for size. We want to know the pure effect of size on price. But we have this problem that size is tangled up with bedrooms.
Right. They are holding hands, as you said. We need to break them up.
So the math effectively does this two-step dance. Step one. Ignore price for a second. We just look at size and bedrooms. We run a regression of size against bedrooms. So we try to predict the size of a house using only the number of bedrooms it has.
Okay, so we are predicting square footage based on room count. And obviously that won't be perfect. There are going to be errors.
Exactly. There will be residuals. And think about what those residuals represent. If a house is huge but has very few bedrooms, it has a large positive residual. This residual is the part of size that cannot be explained by the number of bedrooms. It is the surprise size, the pure size.
It's the size left over after we've stripped away the influence of the bedroom variable.
Precisely. We have partialed out the effect of bedrooms. Now, step two, we take those clean residuals, that pure size variation, and we run a regression of price on that.
So we are seeing how price correlates with the surprise size.
Yes. And the slope of that line is your coefficient B2. That is why we call it the partial effect. The coefficient B2 isn't just the relationship between price and size. It's the relationship between price and size after the explanatory power of size has been reduced by controlling for how the other regressors predict it.
That is a brain twister, but it really makes sense. It's like filtering water. You filter out all the bedroom sediments to get the clear size water, and then you taste that to see how much it costs.
That's a creative analogy, but yes, that's the idea. It's filtering out the noise from the other variables to get the pure signal of that one variable. That is why we can claim we are holding other variables constant.
So let's see what that actually looks like when we get the results. Section 3 of our study guide, interpretation. We've run the model on our Davis houses. We have a list of numbers. The coefficient for size, B2, came back as 68.37.
Okay, stick that number on the wall. 68.37.
And the coefficient for bedrooms, B3, came back as 26.85. Now, The host in me, the guy who just likes big numbers, wants to say, wow, bedrooms are way more important because 2685 is way bigger than 68.
And that is the rookie mistake. That is the number one way to fail your exam. You cannot compare the raw size of coefficients because they are in different units.
Right.
Size is measured in square feet. So 68.37 is dollars per square foot. Bedrooms is just a count. So 2685 is dollars per bedroom. You can't compare the price of a grape to the price of a watermelon just by looking at the number. You have to consider the unit.
Okay, good point. So let's focus on the interpretation of that size coefficient then. 68.37, the source calls this the ceteris paribus effect.
Latin for all other things being equal. This is the standard interpretation script that you must memorize, since B2 is a partial effect, we say. For every additional square foot of size, the predicted price increases by $68.37, holding the number of bedrooms, bathrooms, age, and lot size constant.
That condition, holding everything else constant, is the absolute key. We are imagining a magical scenario where we can stretch a house by one square foot, but we don't add any bedrooms or bathrooms. We just make the existing rooms slightly bigger.
Exactly. And that distinguishes it from what we call the total effect. Remember our simple correlation earlier. If you just ran a regression of price on size alone, ignoring bedrooms, you would get a different number for the slope. That number would be the total effect.
Because in the real world, if I add 500 square feet to a house, I probably am adding a bedroom.
Right. The total effect allows for that natural correlation to exist. The formula for the total effect shows that the simple slope, the one from the simple regression, absorbs the bedroom effect. It says, when I increase size, I get the direct value of the space, which is B2, PLS, or I get the value of the extra bedroom that usually comes with that space. Multiple regression splits those two things apart.
It tells you the value of the space alone. So let's look at the significance. This is where the story gets really juicy for the Davis data. We have T statistics and P values for these coefficients. For size, the P value is 0.000. It's highly significant.
Very significant.
But then look at bedrooms. The p-value is 0.773.
Which is not significant, not even close. Mm. In statistics, usually anything over 0.05 is considered zero evidence. You can't reject the idea that the true effect is zero.
So wait, does that mean bedrooms are worthless? If I knock down a wall and remove a bedroom, the value of my house doesn't drop.
That's a dangerous interpretation. What it means is that once we control for square footage, the number of bedrooms doesn't give us any new information about the price.
Okay, explain that.
Think about it this way. In this specific sample of houses in Davis in 1999, if you have two houses that are both exactly 2,000 square feet, but one has three bedrooms and the other has four bedrooms, The market didn't care. The model is saying there's no statistical difference in their price.
Is that because the four-bedroom house would just have smaller, more cramped rooms?
Exactly. You're just chopping the same amount of pizza into more slices. The market was paying for the pizza, which is the space, not the number of slices you cut it into.
That is fascinating. So the bedroom value we saw in the correlation matrix earlier, where it looked positively correlated with price, was that an illusion? Was it just a proxy for size all along?
In this specific multivariate model, yes. The size variable basically stole all the significance because it was the real driver. Mm. And this is why we do multiple regression. If we just looked at the simple correlation, we'd go around telling people, build more bedrooms to increase value. But the regression says, no, just build more space. The bedrooms don't seem to matter if the space isn't there to support them.
And I'm seeing here that bathrooms and lot size also came back not significant in this model. Basically, size is doing all the heavy lifting here.
It is the dominant variable in this particular data set. Now, we should note the intercept is significant and age is slightly negative, but not statistically significant. But the headline, the big story here is, size matters, and the way you partition that space seems to matter a lot less.
So we have a model, but is it a good model? Just because we have a bunch of numbers doesn't mean they're right. That brings us to section four, goodness of fit.
Right, we need to know how wide our line, or our hyperplane, I guess, actually hits the data points. The first measure is the standard error of the regression, which we call SEE key.
Also known as the root mean squared error. I see this in the notes. It's a dollar amount, right?
Correct. It's a measure of the average distance between the data points and our model's prediction. Okay. It's the size of the typical miss. But notice the formula. It divides by N minus K.
Okay.
N is the number of observations, so 29 in our case. And K is the number of parameters we estimated. That's the number of variables plus the intercept.
Why subtract K? Why not just divide by N like a normal average?
Think of it like a budget. Mm. You have $29 of information, your 29 houses.
Yeah.
Every time you ask the data to estimate a coefficient, you know, how much is a bedroom worth? How much is a bathroom worth? You have to pay $1. You use up a degree of freedom. If you estimate too many things, you use up all your information. Subtractum A accounts for this cost. It makes the divisor smaller, which in turn makes the error term slightly larger. It's a penalty for making the model overly complex.
Speaking of penalties and keeping us honest, let's talk about R squared, the famous R squared. This is the number everyone looks at first.
It's the coefficient of determination. It tells us what fraction of the variation in price is explained by our model. If R squared is 1, we explain everything perfectly. Every house price lands exactly on our prediction line. If it's 0, our model explains nothing. It's totally useless.
In our Davis model with just size, the R squared was 0.618, so about 62% of the price variation is explained by size. When we added all the other variables, bedrooms, baths, age, etc., the R squared went up to 0.651.
It went up.
So, strictly speaking, the bigger model explains more. It went from 61.8% to 65.1%.
But here is the trap, the dangerous trap of R squared. R squared never goes down when you add a variable. Never. Even if you add a variable that is total nonsense like day of the week the realtor was born, the R squared will technically go up a tiny bit, or at best stay the same. It cannot decrease.
Why is that?
Because the math is an optimization machine. If you give it a new variable, it will look for any accidental random correlation in the noise, even a tiny meaningless one. And it will use it to lower the residuals just a fraction of a percent. It's overfitting. It's finding patterns in the clouds.
So if I just chase a high R squared, I will end up with this massive kitchen sink model with 100 variables that means nothing but looks great on paper.
Exactly. And that model will be terrible at predicting new data because it's just memorized the noise in your current data.
Mm.
This is where we bring in adjusted R squared.
The buzzkill of statistics.
Or the voice of reason. Adjusted R squared includes a penalty term. It asks a really important question. Did the new variable explain enough variation to justify the cost of adding complexity? It balances the gain in explanation against the loss of a degree of freedom.
So if the variable is useless...
If the variable is useless, the penalty outweighs the gain, and adjusted R squared goes down.
And looking at our data, this is the smoking gun. For the model with just size, the adjusted R squared is 0.603. For the model with everything, the adjusted R squared is 0.555. It went down.
It dropped significantly. This tells us that the kitchen sink model is actually worse than the simple model with just size. All those extra variables, bedrooms, lot size, bathrooms, they were just adding noise. They didn't pull their weight. Huh. The penalty for adding them was higher than the value they provided.
That is a crucial lesson for the students listening. Bigger isn't always better. Sometimes the simpler model is the more robust one. Just because you have the data doesn't mean you should force it into the regression.
Precisely. And there are even more advanced ways to measure this, which are called information criteria. The notes mention AIC, BIC, and HQIC.
These sound like government agencies.
They do. It's the Akaiki Information Criterion and the Bayesian Information Criterion. They operate on the same principle as adjusted R squared. They penalize the model for having too many variables, for having a large K.
Okay.
The rule of thumb with these is, smaller is better. We prefer the model with the lowest AIC, or the lowest BIC. Generally, BIC applies a stiffer penalty than AIC, so it really, really hates complex models. It's the strictest judge in the room.
Okay, so we've designed the model, we've interpreted it, and we've checked its fit. Now let's talk about implementation. For the student listening who has to sit in a computer lab and actually do this, what are they looking at on the screen?
You're likely using software like Stata, or maybe R.
Mm-hmm.
When you run the regress command, you get a very standard output block. It usually has three parts.
Okay, part one, the ANOVA table. I see it in the notes, usually in the upper left corner.
Yep. This breaks down the sums of squares.
Yep.
You'll see the explained SS or the model SS. That's how much variation we got right. Then the residual SS, which is how much we missed. That's the sum of the squared errors.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the total SS, which is the total variation in the data to begin with.
And you use these to calculate things like R squared.
Exactly. And the F statistic. Then part two. The coefficients. This is usually the bottom half.
This is the important part.
This is the meat of the sandwich. It lists every variable size, bedrooms, etc., in rows. And next to each one, it gives you the coefficient estimate, the B, the standard error of that estimate, the T statistic, and the P value. This is where you look to see, is size significant? You look at the P value column, how much does price change? You look at the coefficient column.
And part three, the summary stats, upper right.
That's the dashboard. You get the number of observations, the R squared, the adjusted R squared. It's the quick overview. But there's one specific error message the source warns us about that students run into all the time. The inestimable model.
This sounds existential. Your model cannot be known.
It's a mathematical failure called perfect collinearity. Remember, the math needs independent variation to work. If one of your variables is a perfect linear combination of the others, the math breaks. It involves trying to divide by zero, which you can't do.
Can you give us an example of how a student might accidentally cause this, like the dummy variable trap?
The classic trap. Suppose you have a variable for Haspool, where yes is 1 and no is 0. And then, try to be really thorough, you create a second variable for no pool, where yes is 1 and no is 0.
Okay, so I have a column saying if I have a pool and a column saying if I don't. It seems redundant.
It's perfectly redundant. If I know you have a pool, so the first variable is a 1, I automatically know that you don't have no pool, so the second variable must be a 0. There is 0 new information in that second variable. If you feed both of those to the computer, the matrix is less than full rank. It collapses.
So what happens? Does it crash?
Stata will spit out an error saying one variable was omitted or not identified. The computer basically says, I'm ignoring the second one because you already told me that information with the first one. You're giving me the same thing twice.
So if you see omitted in your output, check for redundancy. You likely have two variables measuring the exact same thing. Good tip. Speaking of Stata, the notes actually give us the cheat sheet commands, which is helpful. To load data, use a file name.
Uh-huh.
To look at correlations, correlate price size bedrooms. And to run the regression, regress price size bedrooms, and so on with your other variables.
Simple commands, powerful output.
Yeah.
The difficulty isn't typing the command, it's interpreting what comes out of it.
Before we wrap up, I want to circle back to the outro of our study guide. We've covered a lot of ground here. We explored the data with correlations and found the confounding variable trap.
Yeah.
We estimated with OLS, understanding that it minimizes squared errors. We interpreted the coefficients as partial effects, the whole ceteris paribus logic.
Mm-hmm.
And we checked the fit with adjusted R-squared learning to ignore the regular R-squared.
That is the workflow.
Yeah.
That is the process. Memorize that flow. And the notes suggest some in-class exercises that are worth thinking about conceptually, even if you don't do them by hand. For instance, calculating a residual for a specific house. If the model says a house should be worth $300,000 based on its size and age, and it actually sold for $310,000.
The residual is plus $10,000.
Simple arithmetic, but it grounds you in what the model is actually doing. It means that house overperformed the market prediction by $10,000, and then you can ask why. Maybe it had a really nice view. Maybe the buyer was just desperate. That residual holds all the mysteries that our model didn't capture.
And there is a final formal warning in the source. We've touched on it, but it bears repeating. Association versus causation.
Yes, this is so important. OLS regression measures association. The math says a 1-unit change in X is associated with a Y change in price. It does not prove that X caused Y. Just because adding a bathroom is associated with a higher price in the data, it assumes your model is the true causal representation of the world. But what if you omitted a variable like neighborhood quality that correlates with both price and the number of bathrooms?
Then you're in trouble.
Then your coefficient is biased. You aren't really measuring the value of the bathroom. You're accidentally measuring the value of the good neighborhood that tends to have houses with more bathrooms.
So be humble with your conclusions. The model is a map. It is not the territory.
Precisely.
One last thing caught my eye in the results here. It's the p-value for F. In our Davis model, we said bedrooms and baths were not significant individually. Their p-values were terrible. But the p-value for F was 0.0003. That is extremely significant.
Great catch. This is the joint significance test. The F test tests the model as a whole. It asks a different question. It asks, do all these variables taken together as a team explain anything at all? A low p-value there means, yes, this group of variables has predictive power.
So how can the team be good if some of the individual players are bad?
It's multicollinearity again. Since size and bedrooms are correlated, they're fighting over the same variance. Individually, the math can't tell for sure who gets the credit, so it gives them both bad t-stats, high p-values. But together, they definitely explain price.
Okay, I think I get it.
It's like a band. Maybe you can't hear the bass player clearly, and you can't hear the drummer clearly because they're playing over each other in the mix, but you can definitely hear the music. The song is there.
That is a surprisingly accurate analogy. The F test hears the music. The T test tries to isolate the individual instrument.
Exactly. So always check the F test to see if the model has any validity at all before you start cutting variables based on their T stats.
Well, on that musical note, we will leave you to digest the wonders of multiple regression. Remember, whether you are predicting house prices or wages or the stock market, the principles are the same.
They are.
Minimize those residuals. Watch out for the total versus partial effects, and never, ever trust a raw R squared without checking the adjustment.
And always check your definitions. Make sure you know what a half bath actually is in your data.
Thanks for listening to the Deep Dive. Good luck with the data.